Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Detective Real Estate. Law Hour is sponsored by the Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Corden. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on antibiotics when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if your carpenter said that? He who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client. Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or his own steps is incompetent? You know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court just has to be as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor, a law professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about lawyers. He said, quote, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed." And he went on to say it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real, honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed, and a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel, and a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. And he goes on to say that whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. And that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call us here at the law school. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, educational, and informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click on Vmail and send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Antibiotics are everywhere. Antibiotics, like the fluoride and chlorine in your water, is so pervasive in our food supply today that when you eat meat, milk, butter, and eggs, you're taking a certain portion, I shouldn't say percentage, I don't know what the percentage is, but at least a certain portion of that in all of these foods, especially if it's meat, dairy products, and so on, is laced with antibiotics. Now, antibiotics are a miracle drug discovered back in 1928 and perfected in 1941 and used at D-Day in 1944 and after World War II. It's the miracle drug that allows us to go to Flo's Whorehouse on Friday night, pick up a dose of gonorrhea or clap, go to the doctor on Monday morning and tell him what our problem is, and he can dispense to us these miracle drugs called penicillin or Erythromycin or Terramycin or some other antibiotic to cure the disease. It's been a modern cure-all. Doctors prescribe it for colds and flu when they know full well that colds and flu are not receptive or they're not responsive to antibiotic treatment. Everybody likes antibiotics. It's the cure-all. It's the magic panacea. It's like the crucifix that makes Dracula fall down and go away. But there's a hidden danger to these antibiotics that are so all-pervasive in our society. And a story comes out of Iraq concerning a bacteria called Acinetobacter baumannii. I'll spell it for you. It's A-C-I-N-E-T-O-B-A-C-T-E-R. It comes from the web about infectious diseases. Acinetobacter baumannii. That second word is B-A-U-M-A-N-N-I-I. And so you might say, well, what is this Acinetobacter baumannii, a gram-negative bacteria intrinsically resistant to many antibiotics? And as we read in the various news reports, you know, you can pick up Time or Newsweek or Reader's Digest, and you'll read an article from time to time about some superbug that is antibiotic resistant. You've probably read a story or two along that line. And then if you're like me, you know, you say, well, okay, that's too bad, and you go on to something more exciting, more interesting. like the baseball scores or the latest movie page or sports or something else. But the bottom line is that all of us are going to be affected in the near future. I say near future, I say over the next 10, 15 years. If you're old like I am, maybe it won't be quite as big a problem as it's going to be for you young people. But all of us, I think, at some point in time, are going to need an antibiotic. I know three times in my lifetime I've had pneumonia, and I needed that antibiotic. Well, at least I thought I did. There's natural antibiotics. Garlic, raw garlic is one. I didn't know anything about raw garlic when I went to the doctor. And, of course, old Doc Nielsen over in Fortuna, he prescribed penicillin. This was back in the 1950s, when penicillin was the big thing. And then over time, people became either allergic to penicillin or penicillin wouldn't solve their problem for it. So they needed what they call a broad-spectrum antibiotic, something that would kill more than one or two germs. So the pharmaceutical labs, they got busy on that. And these antibiotics are big sellers. I mean, they make billions of dollars. And it's the mainstay of the medical profession. If they didn't have antibiotics, they'd practically be out of business. I mean, without antibiotics, they'd be like plumbers without pipe wrenches. What would they do next? They'd have to go to plastic pipe or something else. They'd have to pick up some new product. So over time now, we Americans in particular have become antibiotic resistant to such a degree that now there's only a couple of antibiotics. When you get right down to it now, and you've got some kind of a disease like this Acinetobacter baumannii, and you need an antibiotic, and you're either allergic to or you're resistant to all of these bacteria. They're down to one or two now, just one or two. And there are some bacteria now that are resistant to every known type of antibiotic. Now think of that for a moment. Because when this becomes pervasive, it won't make any difference what they have to treat you with. It won't work. Now, that's kind of scary. Up until now, we, at least here in the United States, and I suppose in Canada and Australia and Western Europe, we're pretty cocky people. We're sitting here saying, well, it don't make any difference. You send bubonic plague after us, and we'll just use antibiotics and defeat it. Go ahead and just send us a little venereal disease, and we'll just go get our broad-spectrum antibiotics, and we'll just treat that and jig time. But we're getting to a point here where these antibiotics aren't going to work. Now, what are you going to do in their place? Well, somebody will say, well, something will come along. Something will come along. I remember they've been telling us that about AIDS. They've been talking about AIDS, and a cure to AIDS and a vaccine for AIDS since about 1980 or 82 or 3. And let's see, now that's 20 years ago, and we're still sitting here with AIDS growing exponentially worldwide. Without this, something will come along. And we've been waiting for a cancer cure since 1900. Now, that's 107 years, and we haven't got one yet. And I've mentioned that a time or two. You're not going to get a cancer cure either, not as long as cancer is a $500 billion a year industry. Now, these antibiotics, you can rest assured that they're out here just looking for new antibiotics as fast as they can. And the problem is that they can't find them. I guess there's a limit to how many you can create. I don't know if it's 10, 20, 50, 100, or 200, but there's a limit, I guess, out there somewhere. Now, about this Acinetobacter baumannii, where is it found? Well, in water and soil. The bacteria can survive for several days on many surfaces, including those difficult to control, such as cell phones and keyboards. Who gets it? Well, generally speaking, only people who have weakened immune systems are at risk. The disease is generally presented as a nosocomial infection only, meaning that it affects patients in hospitals. Now, I underlined that, patients in hospitals, because 37 million Americans visit the hospital every year. That's as a patient. And I suppose many millions more visit hospitals every year to visit the sick people that are in there. And then there are many millions of other people who work at those hospitals. So the hospital over here, the local medical temple, is a very popular place where many, many millions of people, I'll bet you that there's 200 million Americans that will go into a hospital at least once this year. And many of you are going to go into the hospital many, many times because you work there. So you ought to underline that. That's pretty significant. Well, at least 240 U.S. military personnel have had infections from the A. baumannii bacteria since the Iraq War began in 2003. This A. baumannii was also seen among soldiers during the Vietnam War. So this infection isn't something new. It's been around for a long time, probably since the Garden of Eden. And the disease accounts for only 1.3% of all bloodstream infections in hospitals in the United States. But the disease is on the increase in military healthcare facilities where personnel coming from Iraq, Kuwait, and Afghanistan are being treated. So why is this A. baumannii such a concern? It only affects 1.3% of all bloodstream infections, so what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is that the treatment options are limited, and the already antibiotic-resistant bacteria is becoming resistant to more and more antibiotics. This A. baumannii infection can lead to complications such as pneumonia, fever, and septicemia. In an article by Steve Mitchell for the United Press International, an analyst says that when there is a really serious infectious, doctors are left with nothing to fight them with. Some abominized strains are resistant to all of the treatments that mankind has available today. Let me underline that one for you. Some of these abominized strains are resistant to all of the treatments mankind has available today. Well, now that's pretty shocking, because there's a strain of gonorrhea that came out of Thailand that is also resistant to every known form of antibiotic. And all of a sudden, you know, our fun and frolicking down at Flo's, you know, becomes more life-threatening and more serious, doesn't it? Almost make you want to swear off Flo's place. So how is it treated? Well, the only drug that works on multi-resistant strains of this abominai is called colistin. It's a very toxic drug, and colistin is not often administered because of its toxicity, and it's not available in the United States. Some abominai is also susceptible to treatment with imipenem, also known as cilastatum or primaxin, and other types of carbapenems. So what are the recommendations to prevent a abominai infection? Well, infection control by good hand hygiene and disease isolation, groin, auxiliary, and wound cultures, and military personnel should be monitored carefully for this abominai. Now, that's the lead page in the story. Now, this story comes out of Iraq, and a young man over there in Iraq, a soldier, is blown up, and three of his compatriots are killed at the scene, but he, because of the super duper medical response that's available over there, was stabilized and then brought back to the United States, where he later died of this disease. In other words, he survived the war, but he died from the disease that was caused by the war. And there's another little side story that goes with it. The insurgents are taking this bacteria, and they're wiping it all over the bombs that they're making, so that when the bomb goes off, if it doesn't kill you, then the disease will. Now, that is reminiscent of the Middle Ages, when the various warring factions used to take dead bodies. You know, they take the body of somebody that died from the bubonic plague, load it in a catapult, and then fling it over the walls of a city to introduce bubonic plague or some other form of plague into the target city. This is bacterial warfare or bacteriological warfare. And this concept, you know, of bacteria warfare in Fort Detrick, Maryland, and germ warfare and so on, we think of, at least I do, I think of in modern terms. I thought, you know, this is something that we just dreamed up here in the 20th century to be real nasty to one another, and come to find out why we've been using germ warfare for thousands of years. Did you know that? So the idea of using disease to kill people, you know, even months after the battle is over. For this young man, once that bomb went off, the war was over for him. But he came home and died from the disease introduced into his body at the scene. Now, normally we think of infection as being something that's accidental. It's like an act of God, you know. The guy got shot, he's wounded, and so he's taken off the battlefield, and then he goes on, but then later on he dies of a mysterious infection, or maybe the infection isn't even mysterious. But now we find out that the enemy over there is intentionally introducing the bacteria into the bomb, so that when the bomb goes off, even though we didn't kill you at the scene, we're going to get you months later from this invisible bacteria. Isn't that just real special? It's called the invisible enemy. Now, the Pentagon created the perfect machine for saving the lives of soldiers wounded in Iraq, but then the GI started getting sick. The culprit, a drug-resistant super germ infecting the military's evacuation chain. It's a homemade bomb, exploded under a Humvee in Anbar province in Iraq on August the 21st, 2004. The blast flipped the vehicle into the air, killing two U.S. Marines and wounding another. The wounded Marine, a soft-spoken 20-year-old named Jonathan Gadsden, who was near the end of his second tour of duty in previous wars, he would have died within hours. His skull and ribs were fractured, his neck was broken, his back was badly burned, and his stomach had been perforated by shrapnel and debris. Gadsden got out of the war zone alive because of the Department of Defense's network of frontline trauma care and rapid air transport known as the evacuation chain. So minutes after the attack, a helicopter touched down in the desert. Combat medic staunched the Marine's bleeding, inflated his collapsed lung, and eased his pain. He was airlifted to the 31st Combat Support Hospital in Baghdad, located in an old healthcare facility called the Ibn Sina, which had formerly catered to the Ba'athist elite. Army surgeons were there, and they repaired Gadsden's cranium, removed his injured spleen, and pumped him full of broad-spectrum antibiotics to ward off infection. 3 days later, he was flown to the Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany. It's the largest American military hospital in Europe. He was treated for his burns and his spine was stabilized for the 18-hour flight to the United States. Just a week after nearly dying in the desert, Gadsden was recuperating at the National Naval Medical Center. Now think about this for a second. Here's a guy who's fatally wounded on the battlefield. And he survives because of this super ingenious. I don't know who we're going to give credit to this. Maybe it's Donald Rumsfeld. Anyway, we saved this guy's life. He's taken back to Bethesda, Maryland, and his mother, Zita, was at his bedside. Now, the surgeons, the nurses, the medics, and the pilots of the evacuation chain have saved thousands of lives. Soldiers wounded in Vietnam were 6 weeks of transit time away from a U.S. hospital, and one out of every four of them died. By contrast, a soldier's odds of surviving battle injuries in Iraq are 9 out of 10. Did you get that? Their chances of surviving the injury are 9 out of 10. That's 90%. That's phenomenal. I'll bet you that your chances of surviving an auto wreck in the United States aren't that good. But out on the battlefield, 9 out of 10. Unfortunately, this remarkable advance in battlefield logistics has also resulted in an increase in the number of traumatically injured patients who are particularly susceptible to infections during their recovery. In Gadsden's case, from the moment that he was carried into the Ibn Sina Hospital, the injured Marine was in the crosshairs of an enemy that he didn't even know was there. At first, he did very well. By early September, Gadsden was weaned off his ventilator and breathing on his own. For weeks, he gradually improved. His buddies took him to a Washington Redskins game in his wheelchair, and the next day he navigated 50 feet with a walker. Soon, Gadsden was transferred to a veterans hospital in Florida called the James A. Halley Medical Center, where he offered to serve as the eyes of a fellow Marine blinded in an ambush. The doctors told Zita, his mother, that her son might be able to go home by the end of October. But Gadsden still had some mysterious symptoms that he couldn't shake, like headaches, rashes, and intermittent fevers. So his doctors gave him CT scans, laxatives, methadone, beta blockers, Xanax, more surgery, and more antibiotics. An accurate evaluation of his case was difficult, however, because portions of his medical records never arrived from Bethesda. But if they had, they would have shown a positive test for a kind of bacteria called an Acinetobacter baumannii. And in the taxonomy of bad bugs, Acinetobacter is classified as an opportunistic pathogen. Healthy people can carry this bacteria on their skin with no ill effects. It's a process known as colonization. But in newborns, the elderly, burn victims, patients with depressed immune systems, and those on ventilators, this Acinetobacter infection can kill. And the removal of Gadsden's spleen and the traumatic nature of his wounds made him a prime target. So on October the 17th, the Marine was given a day pass to accompany his mother to Walmart. There, he bought her a purse. But hours after returning to the hospital, his condition deteriorated abruptly. His heart rate and blood pressure were elevated. His white blood cell count was spiking. Nurses noted in his chart that he had become disoriented to place, time, and people, thinking he is at home, sitting up, thinking he's lying down. He struggled through occupational therapy the following morning, shivering and complaining of the cold. Gadsden had a seizure and a heart attack the next day. The neurology team discovered that his cerebrum and cerebellum had swollen up. He was clinically brain dead, and his family and minister were called to the hospital, and on October the 22nd, he was taken off of life support. Now, the Marine Corps Public Affairs Office sent out the customary press release attributing Gadsden's death to injuries as a result of enemy action. But then a few weeks later, Zita's dentist told her that a Florida newspaper was reporting that her son had died of bacterial meningitis. Aided by U.S. Representative Bill Young, Zita, who works as a cardiac care technician in South Carolina, demanded an investigation. And she discovered that an autopsy was performed shortly after her son's death, and the coroner recorded the manner of his death as a homicide, an explosion during a war operation, but determined the actual cause of death to be a bacterial infection. The organism that killed Gadsden, called nocardia, had clogged the blood vessels leading to his brain, but the Acinetobacter had been steadily draining his vital resources when he could least afford it. For weeks, it had been flourishing in his body, undetected by the doctors at Halley, resisting a constant assault by the most potent antibiotics in the medical arsenal. No one said that my son had anything like that, Zita says. I never had to wear gloves or a mask, and none of the nurses did either. No one had any information. Now, since Operation Iraqi Freedom began in 2003, more than 700 U.S. soldiers have been infected or colonized with this A. baumannii bacteria. A significant number of additional cases have been found in the Canadian and British Armed Forces and among wounded Iraqi civilians. The Armed Forces Institute of Pathology has recorded 7 deaths caused by the bacteria in U.S. hospitals, along with the evacuation chain. 4 were unlucky civilians who picked up the bug at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. while undergoing treatment for other life-threatening conditions. Another was a 63-year-old woman, also chronically ill, who shared a ward at Lansdall with infected coalition troops. Now, behind the scenes, the spread of a pathogen that targets wounded GIs has triggered broad reforms in both combat medical care and the Pentagon's networks for tracking bacterial threats within the ranks. Interviews with current and former military physicians, recent articles in medical journals, and internal reports reveal that the Department of Defense has been waging a secret war within the larger mission in Iraq and in Afghanistan. It's a war against antibiotic-resistant pathogens. This Lacina tobacco is only one of many bacterial nemesis prowling around in ICUs and neonatal units in hospitals all over the world. A particularly fierce organism known as MRSA infects healthy people, and it spreads easily, and it accounts for many of the 90,000 fatal infections picked up in U.S. hospitals each year. Another drug-resistant germ on the rise in healthcare facilities is called Clostridium difficile, D-I-F-F-I-C-I-L-E. It moves in for the kill when long courses of antibiotics have wiped out normal intestinal flora. Aha, normal intestinal flora. So let me pause right here and give you a little piece of information. In order to restore that normal intestinal flora, colostrum, that is bovine colostrum, will do that. Just for any of you out there that didn't know. But it's when your normal intestinal flora disappears over here that you don't die from the malady, you die from the loss of the flora in your gut. Now, isn't that just special? It didn't kill you on the battlefield, got you with a bacteria. Then later on here in the article, we'll see that the enemy now are putting this bacteria into the bomb so that when the bomb goes off, make sure that there's plenty of it there so that when you go to the hospital, if they don't catch it, and get this, there's only two of these antibiotics left in the arsenal that'll even touch this particular bacteria. And those two are in short supply nearly everywhere. Now, this isn't a big deal yet, but I would predict that it's going to become a big deal because Revelation chapter 6 tells us that 1/4 of all of the people living on planet Earth today are going to die in a great plague, a great plague. And when this plague takes its course or goes or runs its course, and 1/4 of humanity is wiped out, I suspect that the antibiotics that we have depended upon over the past, 75 years are going to be of no effect. We're going to have plenty of them, and we'll be shooting people up with them, but they're going to be of no effect. And guess where this bacteria really multiplies and really lives the best? It's in your hospital. It's the place that you're all going to want to go to when you get sick, the hospital. And that's the place where this particular bacteria, these microbes over here that are immune to, that are now called super bugs, it's where they live and flourish the best in the hospital. That clean environment of the hospital. Well, hang on here. I've got to tell you a little story here about what you're listening to and where it came from, and that is that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. However, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the management, the sponsors or staff of this network, or of this local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about antibiotics. We are enamored by antibiotics. They have saved mankind. If it hadn't been for antibiotics, mankind would have succumbed long ago. Well, at least so we're told. There was a number that came out of that last paragraph that I wanted to bring to your attention, because if you have been listening, I have presented in the past a series of articles or a series of programs on iatrogenic disease, in which I reported to you that Governor Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton, reported when he was president that iatrogenic disease, it killed 130,000 people in American hospitals every year. That's what they admit to, 130,000 a year. The number is probably two, three, or four times greater than that. However, just using the government's numbers of 130,000, did you catch this number? 90,000 fatal infections are picked up in U.S. hospitals each year. Iatrogenic disease is not a fatal infection that you pick up at the hospital. That's where they cut off the wrong leg, or they cut out the wrong lung, or they gave you the wrong drug, or they gave you the right drug, but they gave you the wrong proportions, for which you died of a doctor-induced disease. On the other hand, the bacteria that you pick up in the hospital, that's another cause of death in the hospital, but it's not doctor-caused. Now, I don't know what they cause that, or what they call that, but now you can raise that up to about 200,000. Now, 37 million people go into the hospital every year. So your chances of being killed by your doctor or picking up one of these diseases isn't all that great. It's there. But, you know, when you go to the hospital, you're not expecting to pick up a bacteria that kills you when you went there to get cured of whatever malady you went there in the first place for, now, right? Now, forerunners of the bug causing the military infections have been making deadly incursions into civilian hospitals for more than a decade. In the early 1990s, 1,400 people were infected or colonized by a single facility in Spain. Then a few years later, particularly virulent strains of the bacteria spread through three Israeli hospitals, killing half of the infected patients. Let me underline that. Killed half of the infected patients. Didn't kill half of the patients in the hospital now, but it killed those that got this bacteria. Killed half of them. Now, when you go to the hospital, your immune system isn't working at 100% now, is it? I mean, isn't that why you went to the hospital? Because you were sick, feeling kind of puny or poorly? So you go to the hospital and you're already weak. This is where these bacteria come into play, because they attack people whose immune systems are weak. And remember, when you're sick, the one place you want to go, the hospital. Take me to the hospital. I want to go to the hospital, the place where people die, or the place where people go to die, and the place where all of these bacteria are lurking. Nevertheless, the bug makes an unlikely candidate for the next mass plague. It preys exclusively on the weakest of the weak and the sickest of the sick, slipping into the body through open wounds, catheters, and breathing tubes. Colonization poses no threat to people who aren't already ill, but colonized healthcare workers and hospital visitors can carry the bacteria into neighboring wards and other medical facilities. Epidemiologist Roberta Carey at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention calls Jacinta Backer and Rodney Dangerfield, or the Rodney Dangerfield of microorganism. It doesn't get a lot of respect because it's not out there bumping off the normal healthy people. Well, this disease is only after the sick. And it is rapidly evolving resistance to all of the antibiotics that used to keep them in check. Now, this death by Jacinta Backer can take many forms: catastrophic fevers, pneumonia, meningitis, infections of the spine, sepsis of the blood. Patients who survive face longer hospital stays, more surgery, and severe complications. Until a few years ago, most strains could be dispatched with a wide variety of drugs. For the most tenacious infections, doctors could rely on a family of ultra-broad-spectrum antibiotics called carbapenems, but strains of Jacinta Backer are emerging now that are immune to every known remedy. Multi-drug-resistant pathogens are an epidemiologist's nightmare, reminders of the dark ages when millions of people died every year of runaway infections. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 28, God gives us another little piece of the puzzle when he talks about diseases that you have never heard of before. Diseases that we've never heard of. here's an example of it. I mean, this is a disease, a pathogen that was created and finished in the 6 days of creation. It's been around. It's in the dirt. It's in the water. It may be on your hands. If your immune system is working, it's no problem to you at all. I mean, if you're healthy, you can eat this stuff, and your body will just dispose of it. Your immune system will dispose of it in short order. But when you become sick and then exposed to this, it'll attack you, and then there's nothing to save you. That's the scary part. So you need to be healthy, and then you need to stay healthy, bottom line. Now, there's a natural antibiotic. Now, I don't know if anybody's thought about this. It's called garlic, and there may be others. It comes to my mind, a natural antibiotic. Could well be that garlic would kill this bacteria. Of course, you can rest assured that medical science will never use garlic as an antibiotic because there's no money in it. No money in it. Stuff sells for about $4 a pound. It's imported from China now. But I thought I'd pass it on to you just in case something like this comes up and nothing else works. You know, you might try something natural created by God himself. Now, we've been looking at this Acetobacter in real time for years and years in our lab, says John Quinn. He's a scientific director of the Chicago Infectious Disease Institute. He said, then all of a sudden in 2005, we started seeing more bacteria that were resistant to the carbapenems, the first one out of 10 bugs, then four out of 10, and then almost all of the bacteria. So there's a new sheriff in town, and that spells clinical disaster. The seriousness of this shouldn't be underestimated, because this bacteria now is resistant to every known antibiotic, and antibiotics are the only course of treatment that these people know of. So if you get this disease, you're dead. It's kind of like getting bubonic plague back in 1340. If your immune system can't deal with it, then it can't be dealt with. Now, a strong, healthy immune system up and running doesn't have any problem keeping this bacteria in check. So there's a natural way of dealing with it. That's why I think that a natural antibiotic like a garlic that you don't become immune to, you know, like these antibiotics that you take every day. Now, I mentioned this a little earlier. Let me tell you again that all of us are exposed to these antibiotics in our food. For instance, in the feedlots where they're feeding your Outback steak. You know, you go to the Outback or you go down to Steak and Ale and you order a piece of prime rib or a steak dinner. And did you know that steak is laced with antibiotics? And then you pick up a dozen eggs down at the store and you bring them home, you cook them up. Did you know that your eggs are laced with antibiotics? And then you go to the store, you buy some milk, and then you bring the milk home. Did you know that your milk is also laced with antibiotics? You butter a piece of toast, you know, and you put it on. Well, of course, maybe you're using margarine, but if you're using butter, then the butter is a dairy product. Cheese is a dairy product. Yogurt, you know, dairy product. All these dairy products. And here's what's happening. They put these antibiotics into the feed. They put it right into the feed, and we feed it to the animals. Nobody wants to know what animals or what would happen to our agriculture if we didn't put these antibiotics into the feed, because we're so dependent upon them now for agricultural production. It's just like the fluoride and the chlorine in your water. You know, you go in and you take a shower. And you don't think anything about getting dosed with these two deadly poisons. Just taking a shower is equal to drinking a quart of chlorinated and fluoridated water. Just the shower alone. That's what your skin absorbs. So, you know, when you go down to McDonald's and you order a Big Mac, you don't think about the antibiotics that are in the hamburger meat, you know, that you're eating. And that's what your problem is. You've been eating these foods laced with these antibiotics until today. Most people here in the United States are antibiotic resistant to begin with. Then if they get pneumonia or something that they really, you know, they really need an antibiotic to treat, if their doctor hasn't been filling them full of antibiotics, you know, as a gimmick to sell them something, you know, the people when they go to the doctor, they got to be sold something. So the doctors are busily selling these people antibiotics, and then the agricultural people are busily putting these antibiotics into all the meat, milk, butter, and eggs that they're eating until they just become totally resistant to the antibiotics. And then in the final analysis, when they really need this antibiotic, it's of no effect. So now they've got to go to the two or three antibiotics called broad spectrum, which are reserved for the superbugs just to get the kind of effect that we used to get from simple penicillin and simple antibiotics. Now, that's why I brought to your attention Deuteronomy 28 and Revelation chapter 6, because we're being set up, boys and girls, whether it's by God or whether it's by our own carelessness or whatever, we're being set up for a disease or a pandemic, an epidemic of such proportions that it's going to kill 25% of the Earth's population. That's 1.5 billion people, guaranteed by God himself. Guaranteed. and probably within the lifetimes of a lot of you. Now, I'm getting kind of old, so I might miss it. But, you know, if you're in your 20s and you're taking a look at the world today with the world's population growth, you know, we're growing at the rate of 100 million people a year. So every 10 years, we're adding a billion people to the population. Last time I heard, there's about 6.5 billion people in the world. 6.5 billion. Adding about a billion every 10 years, which means that by the year 2017, which is 2017, there should be about 7.5. And then by about 2027, there should be about 8.5. And then 2037, it should be about 9.5. And this grows geometrically, so you know it'll grow a little bit bigger and better than that. As we progress along, how many people do you think we can feed on this planet? Keeping in mind that about 15 million people a year die from starvation on planet Earth. We have a 38-day supply of food on planet Earth. That's for everybody. 38-day supply doesn't strike me as being an overabundance. So I just thought I'd bring that to your attention. And then you add to this AIDS. Then you add to this the wars and the potential of global warming. And then you add to that nuclear war. And, you know, all these various and sundry problems spoken of in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21 as being the precipitators to this thing called the Great Tribulation. You know, it makes you kind of wonder, is this thing going to happen in our lifetime? And shucks, I might even live to see it, you know, if I lived another 10 or 20 years. Maybe I might get to see it. Now, to battle these new strains, clinicians are being forced to dust off a World War II-era relic called colistin, which is so toxic that it causes kidney damage in as many as 1 in 4 patients who take it. In 2004, the Infectious Disease Society of America included Acinetobacter as its on its bad bugs, no drug short list of pathogens that are raising significant public health concerns. And according to a recent CDC study, the new multi-drug resistant organisms are almost 4 times more deadly than the older strains. That's caused by this overuse of antibiotics in our foods. Notice now that they're telling us that these are 4 times more deadly than the older strains. Now, these bacteria not only are bad and deadly, but it becomes a multiplier, 4 times more deadly. Almost reminds you of Leviticus 26, and he says, now, this is God speaking, he says, now, if you won't be reformed by all of this, I'll punish you 7 times more for your sins. I'll give you 4 times more deadly bacteria on top of that. The reason I bring this to your attention is that maybe there's time for you to take some evasive action before this comes down, because once it comes down, it's kind of like the Titanic, you know. You know, once the crew decided that, well, we're going to set a new transatlantic record, and we're not going to steer south, and we're not going to slow down, we're going to speed up, and we're going to take this ship straight through 5,000 square miles of icebergs, and we're going to weave in and out of them, and we're going to dodge them all. It's almost like driving through a busy intersection against a red light. We're going to weave in between the traffic going in the opposite direction, or going in the two directions across your bow here. Anyway, once you've set that course, and it seems like the people here on planet Earth have already set that course, that now we have to sit back and watch for the results and know what's going to happen. So he goes on to say here, they're spreading fast. A major outbreak in Chicago 2 years ago infected 81 patients, killing 14. Well, let's see how many that is. Let's take 14, divide that by 81. Killed 17%. You know, not anything to get too excited about, but nearly 1 in 5. Which means that, you know, you get a hold of one of these superbugs over here and your chances of surviving it are 20%. Now, if your immune system is impaired, your chances of dying move up to about 100%. Remember those numbers? Now, unfortunately, it doesn't affect very many people. Well, at least not yet. But, you know, the more and more of these antibiotics that you take, the more antibiotic resistant you become until the superbug hits you, and when it hits you, there is no known remedy. See, it makes me feel good to know that if I get pneumonia today, there's antibiotics to treat it with. That makes me feel real good. Makes me feel pretty confident. On the other hand, if you came to me and said, well, pneumonia now, Gordon, because you're antibiotic resistant, pneumonia is no longer on the list. And we can't cure it any longer with antibiotics. So if you get pneumonia, you're just dead, or your immune system is going to have to kick in and save you. Well, shucks, kids, if you got pneumonia, your immune system wasn't strong enough to keep you from getting pneumonia. What makes you think it's strong enough to cure it? You know, just a little thought there for you. So they're spreading fast. Major outbreak in Chicago 2 years ago infected 81, killed 14. Arizona health officials tracked more than 200 infections in state hospitals last year. Doctors at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Tennessee used to see an infection or two every year. Now it's one or more a month. And these bacteria are developing very, very quickly, says CDC epidemiologist Arjun Srivastava, who has been consulting with the DOD about the military outbreak. The bad news is that we're many years away from having any new drugs to treat them. It should be a call to arms. Notice how they kind of glibly throw in, hey, it may be many, many years before we have new drugs to treat them. Aren't we still looking for some new drugs here to cure AIDS, cancer, heart attack? Can you name any disease that medical science has been able to cure through drugs? Just name them, would you? Well, there are a few, but they're so few and far between. You know, like pneumonia and penicillin, you know that of the 450 diseases or symptoms that we develop, we have treatments, but no cures. Treatments and no cures. So that just tells us that, well, once you get this bacteria, you can spend the rest of your life as an invalid taking some kind of drug, which will keep it in check for 5 years. And if they keep it in check for 5 years, they call that a cure. Now, I can remember having pneumonia once when I was a kid. And I went to the hospital, and they gave me penicillin. And I was in the hospital for about 2 weeks, and when I walked out of there, I was cured. No more pneumonia. It's gone. Now, that's a cure. That lasted more than 5 years. You know, that was 65 years ago or 60 years ago. Now, today, they say, well, if you live 5 years, we're going to call that a cure. Kids, that's not a cure. That's a Band-Aid. Nothing more, nothing less. Band-Aid. You either live or you die. You know, if they postpone your death for 5 years and you die from AIDS later on, that's still dead. Now, here's another little kicker before we close here. Tuck this away in your heart. But these diseases over here that are no longer curable are growing in their virility. They're getting worse. And they're growing geometrically. There are now more pathogens, more disease bugs out there that are no longer treatable by antibiotics or some other form of drug than ever before. It isn't just this one. There is a stable full now of those. Tuck that one away in your heart. And they're also growing geometrically. We had one or two a year. Now we get one or two a month. Pretty soon it'll be one or two a week. I'm about out of time. I got to close and remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And that the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement, and the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, we're out of time. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.